Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, August 17th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Today on the show, Cherry, really interesting conversation and back and forth about antidepressants. It's been 40 years since Prozac really kind of changed the game for mental health treatment in the United States and across the world. And there's this kind of growing backlash now about, A, are these drugs being overprescribed? B, what are the side effects? And C, specifically the side effects around trying to get off the drugs.
Yeah.
RFK Jr. really has been the one driving some of the conversation around this the past few months. But there's kind of legitimate back and forth in the psychiatric community now about this conversation.
Yeah, and the statistics that sort of stuck out to me is that you have 1 in 6 Americans now on antidepressants, and not all of them are using them to treat depression. And so this definitely has a robust conversation because the way to get off is not easy for some of these folks. And so we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Have you or loved ones had experience with antidepressants? How did it go? This is a safe space. Feel free to use an alias if it would make you feel more comfortable in sharing your story. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And it's just so many people using these drugs, and sometimes for many, many, many years.
Yeah, and I'm excited for today's show because we do have two psychiatrists coming on in a bit who really, you know, have different views on this, and we can kind of unpack the best and worst of the ideas that are out there and see what they think about them and hopefully get some good input from our listeners today.
Yeah, and again, the question, have you or loved ones had experience with antidepressants? How did it go? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube, hello, you can leave your experiences in our live chat. And so we have our trio of local news stories, Kevin. And by the way, I'm looking forward to working with you. First story, pretty serious one. A Philadelphia police officer died on Sunday. He was off duty and was shot along with another person outside of an after-hours lounge in Southwest Philadelphia. PPD sources identified the slain off-duty officer as 29-year-old Al-Hussein Berry. A surveillance video obtained by our news partner 6ABC shows a commotion outside of Nipsey's Hookah Lounge in the 7200 block of Elmwood Avenue. Police responded around 4 a.m. on Sunday morning and found Berry, as well as a 35-year-old man, both suffering from multiple gunshot wounds, and both men were taken to the hospital. They underwent surgery. Unfortunately, Berry did not survive. Here is Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel.
Unfortunately, we met with the trauma surgeons. They did a valiant effort. My officer suffered a catastrophic injury, and as a result, he did not make it. And so we continue to ask the community for their prayers. We will continue to pray for his family. Fortunately, they were at his bedside. But we are here now to support the family, support the men and women he worked with in the 12th District. These are very difficult moments for us.
Yeah, difficult moments indeed. It is unclear at this point what led to that shooting, Kevin, and police have yet to identify a suspect. And the latest is that the gunman is still at large, and police are asking for witnesses to come forward. And as for that after-hours lounge, not a lot is known about it. According to reports from 6ABC, the property where the shooting occurred received several L&I violations since 2021 for failure to have proper zoning to operate a late night lounge. But people said, look, you just go there for drinks, go there for a little hookah. It's a hangout spot.
Yeah. And, you know, some reporters talked to neighbors who talked about how, you know, they weren't surprised that this happened because this is kind of a nuisance bar in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they're used to lots of commotion and problems surrounding this. So, you know, hearts out to the family here, but also to the neighbors who, you know, live in this area and, you know, wish that something more could be done on a more consistent basis.
Yeah. And I want to just mention that he's Muslim, Officer Berry, rest in peace, and funeral arrangements are pretty quick. They're happening today.
Yep.
Rest in peace to him.
Story number two, Cherry. The first phase of SEPTA's overhaul of its bus system is kicking off this upcoming Sunday and includes changes to 30 routes. Most impacted areas are considered to be South Philadelphia, Kensington, Juniata, the Cheltenham Avenue Corridor, the Lancaster Avenue Corridor, and Roxborough. And these are changes that are meant to make the system faster, more efficient, more reliable along SEPTA's most traveled commutes. And you might remember, it feels like we've been talking about this forever, Cherry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They started kicking around this conversation in 2021, went through a whole planning phase. There was an invitation for the community to be part of the conversation. Lots of community pushback, lots of pushback from local politicians. They started reworking it. Then they got hit with this funding crisis, SEPTA did.
And there's a
lawsuit. So it's just finally now happening. We've heard about this thing, bus revolution, for years. Well, the first phase is kicking off this Sunday. And then there's another four phases through 2027. Month by month next year. So that's what will be happening in SEPTA land.
Yeah. All I have to say is brace yourself, people. You know, Philadelphia doesn't necessarily like change. But there's a need for efficiency, consistency, and reliability. If you know people who catch the bus, that's what they really want. And these changes are meant to help that.
Yeah, it's like you want to know that the bus is going to be there when it says it's going to be there, and you can rely on it consistently. And they saw that wasn't happening, and they saw ridership drop, and that's what precipitated them to look into this in the first place. So hopefully this delivers on that promise without too much heartache for commuters.
Absolutely. Was there anything else you want to add about
SEPTA? No, I think we should just jump right to story three.
All right. So third story, South Broad Street, a.k.a. Avenue of the Arts, they have had some new median planters, like right in the middle of the street. And some say they are big and bad for that stretch of the road. Right. Too big and just bad for the stretch. The planters, they are 4 feet tall. They're made of concrete. They're smack dab in the middle of Broad Street. The plan is for them to run continuously south from City Hall to Washington Ave. They are planters. So there's greenery in them. And there's also a plan to put trees in them as well. Right now, there's a beta test for the streetscape project, and it's right outside of the Kimmel Center, so you can kind of tell what it's going to look like once all of the planters have been installed. And the goal, though, is to make this area of the street more attractive. But some say that this idea, these planters are too big, they're too tall, and once you add trees, it will feel like a wall that is basically turning South Broad Street into a highway. The other rub with this project is that it is going to cost an estimated $150 million. That's $15 million per block to install these planters. And shout out to Alan Greenberger and Harris Steinberg, who wrote a pretty strong opinion piece against these planters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. They say that these planters would further isolate the two sides of the street, and they would crowd out any street life that exists in that 10 block stretch. And a lot of folks feel like something needs to be done on the Avenue of the Arts, but maybe not this. Your thoughts?
Well, I would just point out that the Avenue of the Arts Incorporated, which is run by Carl Dranoff, who is a developer, they're the ones who are spearheading the project. And they say that, like, there's benefits to this. And they see this first block as a beta test, but they say it's going to reduce traffic problems where people aren't going to be making illegal U-turns or parking in the middle of the street. It's going to bring down jaywalking problems related to that. Also, they say that, some of the problems maybe that are cited in this article, they think those will be mitigated by just, individualizing what they're doing block by block. So it's not all going to look exactly like what we're seeing here in front of the Kimmel Center. Mm-hmm. It will be designed so that there's a, you can still take those great photos out front of City Hall at Walnut if you're the bride and groom. There's always the bridal party.
I will say, Kevin, I was wondering about that because people love the medians. They love to stand there. I've done it, and I was like, what are they going to do? Just turn this into an area with some trees? Are people going to climb up on these things? And they're pretty tall because they'll be like above your car, it seems like.
Right.
With these planters, and it might make you feel a little closed in when you're in your car on either side of the street. I don't know how it's going to feel driving down South Broad Street.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the underlying question here is, what do you do to get more people excited about being on South Broad Street? And that's been, kind of a problem that has never fully been solved, it seems. It just never gets the foot traffic. It never gets kind of the community hubbub feel that people think it should have. Mm-hmm. And so this is one plan to try to make that happen. Now,
to put some medians with some plants in the middle of the street. Yeah.
These authors that we highlighted today think that it's going to do quite the opposite. So
yeah.
It's an interesting civic debate.
It's just so expensive. $150 million. I don't know. $15 million a block. We're going to see. I got to go down there and check this out because I have not been to that stretch of the road, but we're going to check it out. The other thing we're going to be talking about today is the rise in the use of antidepressants. We're talking about the MAHA movement to, you know, talk about overprescription, also coming off of them. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCoury in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Antidepressants have become increasingly common in the past several decades. For many, they've been life-changing. But recently, they've come under heightened scrutiny. One of the most vocal critics has been Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. Here he is this past May.
Too many patients begin treatment without a clear understanding of the risks and how long they will stay on these drugs or how to come off of them. And that's not informed consent. We are going to fix it.
RFK Jr. isn't the only one calling for changes to the psychiatric status quo. So today, we're going to look at how the discourse around mental health treatment is evolving and what might come of it. To kick off this segment, we're joined by health reporter at Stat News, Sarah Todd. Sarah, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you or loved ones had experience with antidepressants? How did it go? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email us, studio2@whyy.org, or leave a comment in the live chat on YouTube or Facebook. Why don't we kick off the conversation today, Cherry, with Ruth on line two, who has some really interesting experience with this. Ruth, what's your question or comment for us today?
Hi, I have a comment. I'm no fan of RFK Jr., but I understand his concerns all too well. I have a comment concerning the medication Cilinor, which is an antidepressant. Cilinor is part of a class of antidepressants called sedating antidepressants. My daughter took it because she was having problems with her sleep. And she also had a medication that was specifically for sleep, but she ran out of it. And she decided to, I don't know, double up or triple up maybe on the Cilinor in an effort to help her sleep. She overdosed on it quite accidentally and died almost 11 years ago.
Wow. I'm so sorry.
And now you may be familiar with Public Citizens Public Health Research Group. They have named Cilinor as a do-not-use medication. And I just wanted to say that the pharmaceutical industry has traditionally not been as vigilant as they should be in vetting these medications before they go on the market and making sure that not only are doctors well aware of the possible side effects, but the patients who take them as well.
Well, thank you so much, Ruth.
And Ruth, I'm sorry about the loss of your daughter. That's the testimony from Ruth from Philadelphia. And so, Sarah Todd, want to bring you into the conversation here. A lot of folks seriously concerned, like Ruth, about antidepressants. And so, you know, I want you to sort of just give us an understanding of the discourse that RFK Jr., our health secretary, have started around this. What are some of the arguments for this increased scrutiny of this class of drug?
Yeah. So, you know, RFK is sort of leading the conversation on this, but as Ruth's, you know, tragic story demonstrates, there are a lot of people who are really concerned about antidepressants and the question of, you know, how to get off of them. So RFK's stance is that people are generally overprescribed antidepressants. He's focused on SSRIs specifically, and he has, you know, convened a panel last year that was focused on the use of SSRIs among pregnant women specifically. That was very controversial because they have been shown to be safe for pregnant women, and the risks of a pregnant person becoming depressed while pregnant also carries its own health risks. But then, you know, right now he's putting together some federal guidance on deprescribing SSRIs and says that the goal isn't to, you know, mean that people who want SSRIs can't have them, but to help people who would like to get off of them have a path toward doing so. And as with so many things MAHA related, I would say that, you know, from a health perspective, it's a real mixed bag. The conversation that I've heard from experts is like, yes, there are definitely reasons why we need more research into how to get people safely off of antidepressants. At the same time, we really don't want to discourage people from using what can be a life-saving medication.
And as I understand it, maybe the push is to have more of a conversation up front with a potential patient to say, if you're on this, and if you're on this for an extended time, this is what the side effects could be. This is what it could mean to try to get off of it later. And maybe those conversations aren't happening as much as they should. Do you have a thought on that, Sarah?
Yeah. Speaking from personal experience, you know, I didn't have a conversation when I first went on them about what it might look like to get off. And I would imagine that lots of people don't. So, yeah, I think certainly there's nothing to be lost from a more upfront conversation during the prescription process about, you know, what getting off could look like, what withdrawal symptoms you might expect. And of course, if and when a patient makes that decision, like to have that be closely supervised by a healthcare provider.
Yeah. And Sarah, just to follow up, I want you to explain a little bit of your personal story. You actually wrote about this. You were on antidepressants and then went through multiple steps to actually get off of them. Could you tell us a little of your story?
Sure. Yeah. So the brief backstory is that I went on them for the first time when I was in my early 30s. I was dealing with some mixture of depression and anxiety, mostly related to sort of being on my own in a big city and feeling a little bit lost, a lot of circumstantial stuff, but maybe also some, you know, biological stuff as well. So I went on a generic form of Lexapro called escitalopram and found that it was really helpful for me. And it stabilized my mood so that I could make other positive changes in my life and started feeling a lot better. Then, you know, I just kind of stayed on them because they were working well and I wasn't really experiencing side effects. But after about 10 years, I decided that I wanted to try getting off of them. And I can talk more about that if you would.
Sure.
Like,
Yeah,
please do.
So the process was basically I talked about this with my psychiatrist, and we decided that I would do tapering, which is where you reduce your dosage little by little over time. And the idea is that this will mitigate withdrawal symptoms. And so I did that, and I did experience withdrawal symptoms, but not anything super harsh or scary. I, you know, was more tearful than usual, I would say. I was probably a little more tired, too, maybe a little, like, fuzzier around the edges of my thinking. I think I noticed that I'm a reporter, and I was a little slower with my stories. But, you know, that did, that tapered off as well, and then I was off of them. But then the story has a twist, which is that I eventually did go back on antidepressants, too. And I think that that kind of gets at one of the big confusing parts of the conversation about withdrawal from SSRIs is that it's really challenging to distinguish between what is a relapse of the initial symptoms that you were taking the antidepressants for in the first place and what is the withdrawal symptoms from the medication. So I noticed that overall my mood was lower. I felt more sad more often. And I wasn't sure, is that still lingering withdrawal effects or is that me? But ultimately I talked it through with my psychiatrist and my therapist, and they sort of said, you know, think of it like if you were taking statins for your heart or some other type of medication for a chronic disease. You know, why is it so important for you to be off of them if you're not really experiencing negative side effects from them and they're benefiting your health? And I didn't have a great counter to that, so I did go back on.
And I want to get your take because the statistics that we're hearing is that 1 in 6 Americans are using these drugs, and that this, you know, it's not all of it is for depression. Like you mentioned, it's anxiety. It's that there's some other uses for these drugs. Your thoughts on why there's been so many, and why this conversation that we're having hasn't been brought to the forefront sooner?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think that probably for a long time there was just so much excitement and maybe relief around the fact that there was this medication that worked for a lot of people. Maybe there weren't so many people weren't so worried about how to get off. The question was more just how to stop the symptoms that were preventing them from living the lives that they wanted to lead. But now, you know, I think the simple answer is just that the medications have been around long enough now that we've got more data on people trying to come off and having a hard time with that. And so now there's more scrutiny on the question of when and how to help people get off medication.
I'm thinking, Sarah, if you wouldn't mind, just for someone who is listening, who has never been on one of these, could you just kind of describe what it's like to live with and without it and how it impacts your life?
Sure. And you know, I'm speaking from personal experience. I
Sure.
think lots of people have lots of different reactions to antidepressants, so your response may vary. But for me, what it was like to go from not being on medication to being on medication was basically like it just takes the edge off a little bit to the sort of like strength and harshness of my reactions to things, which was helpful. And you know, they say it's a mood stabilizer. That's really how it worked for me. So some people may experience, you know, side effects that they really don't like. Like they might feel more numb, for example, is a common complaint. For me, that really wasn't the case. I still felt the full range of human emotions. I felt happy and sad and mad and all of those things. But you know, in a way where I was more able to cope with those emotions and then take the positive steps that I needed to improve my life, whether that was, you know, moving to a new apartment or taking up running or those types of things.
And you talked about crying in your piece as kind of the thing that really came back when you were off the drug. And now you're back on, so I'm guessing you're crying less. Do you miss that? Like, how do you grapple with that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's probably the most noticeable side effect. So when I'm on antidepressants, I really have a hard time crying. It's not that I never do it, but it's more unusual. And it also doesn't happen in the situations that might normally set it off. Like, you know, off antidepressants, I cry, you know, at a moving commercial featuring an animal, and I cry at the thought of people helping me with my stroller when I go up and down the staircase. On antidepressants, I think that it's, you know, even, you know, say like at a funeral of somebody I really cared about, I might not cry, and it doesn't mean that I don't feel sad. But one of the things that this drug does is it just actively suppresses your tear ducts. So the emotion is there, but the physical response is not.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Joanne from Oxford, Pennsylvania says, I have lived with depression for a long time. Nothing helped. I felt like I wasted time and money being prescribed these medications. I felt like I was a guinea pig for doctors. We have about a minute and a half left in this segment, but I wondered, Sarah Todd, like how you having, you know, great professionals working with you, like you'd made the decision to get off, then you'd made the decision to get back on. Can you talk about that partnership with doctors? Because it doesn't always work. There is some trial and error that goes with both getting on an antidepressant and getting off.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about that person's experience. I do think that, you know, for a lot of people, they might have to try several medications before they find one that works. And that can be, and experiment with doses too. And that can be a frustrating process. We also know that in our healthcare system, the very act of finding a therapist or a psychiatrist to help you with this can be its own obstacle. There are certainly plenty of burdens that come along with this. It might be hard for people to afford it with insurance. So none of this is meant to minimize all the challenges that may come into play. And for me, certainly, it was really important to have healthcare providers who were really thoughtful. And also, you know, in my experience, the first medication that I tried did work and was effective. So I didn't have to sort of ping pong between different medications.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sarah Todd, for sharing your story with us and also your reporting. Sarah Todd is a health reporter at STAT. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
And we have to take a quick break, but when we're back, we'll speak with a couple of psychiatrists about these tensions that we've been talking about with antidepressants and what the future of mental health treatment might look like.
Yeah, and so if you have a story, if you or your loved one have taken antidepressants, tell us what it's been like for you, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. We have a couple callers. We'll hear from them. Other folks have written in. This is Studio 2. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Today we're talking about antidepressants and the back and forth around possible overprescription and how to best taper off the meds. With us to talk about it.
Yeah, we have Dr. Mark Horowitz, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Adelaide University. He's also co-founder of the National Psychiatric Deprescribing Clinic and the National Health Service in the UK. Dr. Horowitz, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me here.
Yes.
Good to see you.
Yes, and we also have Dr. Roger McIntyre, Professor of Psychiatry and Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Toronto. Dr. McIntyre, welcome to Studio 2.
Good to be with you.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. Our question of the day once more, have you or your loved ones had any experience with antidepressants? How did it go? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in the live chat on YouTube and Facebook.
Yeah, and before we get all the details of SSRIs and overprescribing and all that, I want to reiterate the statistics. 1 in 6 of U.S. adults are currently taking an antidepressant. So RFK Jr. has laid out all sorts of problems with this. I want each of you to lay out your position on how we got here. Do you agree with RFK Jr. that these drugs are potentially overprescribed without an exit ramp? And if so, why? I want to start with you, Dr. Horowitz.
I guess the where things have got to in America is there's been decades of over-medicalizing people's problems. You know, we've just heard from a woman who had trouble adapting, moving to a new city, New York City, not the easiest place to get used to, feels down and anxious. You know, that happens to all of us. We know the stats are that by the age of 45, 86% of us will meet criteria for a mental health condition, and 70% of us will meet criteria for clinical depression or anxiety. So it's more of us than not. And, you know, with a lot of the influence of pharmaceutical companies, a lot of leadership from biological psychiatrists, we've been given this message that these issues are caused by illnesses in our brain, things like the chemical imbalance theory that we have low serotonin and there are drugs that can rectify that. And we know now that in America, about 85% of the public believes that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance, even though all the research doesn't find that. And we know if you believe that, you're more likely to want an antidepressant. You're also more likely to feel that you can't really help yourself because you've got a chemical deficiency in your brain. And so a lot of Americans, in fact, now 56% of Americans have at some point been prescribed an antidepressant. So 1 in 6 today, but overall in their lives, it's more than half. So there has been a huge increase in the uptake of these medications, and there are lines around like, taking an antidepressant for depression is like taking insulin for diabetes or a statin for heart disease. But there are lots of differences between antidepressants and statins or insulin. I think the first thing is that, you know, insulin reverses the underlying cause of diabetes, but antidepressants, you know, don't do that. We know now that depression is not caused by low serotonin. What we do hear a lot is echoed in what Sarah said, that a lot of people on these drugs feel emotionally numb, they can't cry, you know, their emotional range from very high to very low has been squished into the middle. And if you're very anxious, depressed, that can be a relief to have the volume turned down from a 10 to a 3. But you lose a lot of other things. People talk about a lack of intimacy, of enjoyment, of enthusiasm. And so I think the long-term consequences of these drugs haven't been fully priced in. And a lot of people like Sarah turn up and want to feel the full spectrum of human emotions. A lot of the studies on these drugs are very short term. They go for a few weeks. And so this long term use now, average 5 years in America, is far beyond what most studies show. So, I think it's very timely for RFK Jr. to bring these issues up, although I don't agree with everything that he says.
And we'll dig into that a little bit more, Dr. Horowitz. And Dr. McIntyre, I'd love to get your position on this widespread use of antidepressants and your take on what RFK Jr. has had to say about them.
Yeah, and specifically on the issue, as you mentioned, overprescribing, I think, first of all, the discourse, the dialogue, really, really, I think, hinges on what are we actually talking about? What does overprescribed actually mean? To pick up on Mark's metaphor with insulin and diabetes, are we overprescribing insulin as well? I don't know what that even means. What I would actually say is maybe we should back up a little bit. What I would say is this. We all, in fact, are not waking up in the morning and wanting people to be on antidepressants. 1 in 6 is the current estimate. This is startling. By the way, that's not too much different than how many people are taking GLP-1s across the country as well. Just put that in a bit of perspective. So they're frequently prescribed. Second is, I think in addition to 1 in 6 people being prescribed an antidepressant, here's the other statistic. Only 1 in 6 people with depression are receiving treatment that is remotely considered evidence-based and adequate. In other words, most of these antidepressants are being prescribed for reasons other than depression. In other words, people take them for anxiety, for sleep, for pain, so on and so forth. So I think there's different conversations going on here. The other part is, too, is that I think we need to step back even further. And the question really is, what are we treating? We're treating what is been referred to as the world's greatest cause of disability. In fact, just 2 months ago in Lancet, the Global Burden of Disease was published. This is a large study, looks at the burden of illnesses around the world. And here comes depression and anxiety as one of the top contributors. In the United States alone, you know, one in 10 people per year experience depression. These are common conditions. And they shorten people's lifespan, they're lethal, and they also, in fact, shorten their health span, the years that they're healthy. So we're talking about a very, very serious condition. Now, the evidence for these treatments is convincing. They work. Yeah. So for me, at least, overprescribing doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know what that means. It's like saying we're overprescribing insulin. But what I would say, we have an implementation gap, the gap between what our knowledge is and what should be happening. The truth is only 1 in 6 people with depression actually receive adequate treatment.
Yeah. Dr. McIntyre, could you expand further? I think what we were hearing in Dr. Horowitz's commentary was kind of a general skepticism around, you know, the idea that we need a pill for everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've heard in some of our comments and callers so far, the skepticism towards the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, pharma is out for itself and not out for me kind of a mentality. Right. How do you respond to that? And you're connected with pharma to some degree, right?
Yeah, I am. I certainly am. I've been involved in research and pharmacology for almost 30, in fact, more than 30 years and counting. You start losing count after 20, 25 years. Look, I think that there's never been a surplus of trust with psychiatric medications. Going back to the introduction of antidepressants in the 1950s, at least the contemporary antidepressants. Secondly, there is no question that in the pursuit of simplicity, there has been a description of depression that I think has been overly simplified. Clearly, it's a complex disorder. And thirdly, what I might say is I think people have a legitimate valence to their complaint that their depression was narrowed down to just take a pill and come back in 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that is a function of the healthcare system, wherein reimbursement for psychosocial treatments and therapy is not in surplus. And access to healthcare providers who can provide those services is not in surplus. And finally, I speak to practitioners. Remember, most practitioners across the country prescribing antidepressants are not psychiatrists.
Yeah.
They're primary care nurse practitioners and so on. And they are wonderful people, well-intended. They tell me all the time, Roger, my quality of life sucks as a practitioner. I say, why? Well, because I have to see 10 patients an hour. I got to see 6 patients an hour. I'm under pressure to see. These are systemic problems. So I think it's actually a very good point. I think, in fact, the treatment of depression today is not just with an antidepressant. I've been running a pharmacology program for decades. I've never met anyone who's adequately treated just with an antidepressant. So I think that's true.
Yeah.
But I think we're just talking antidepressants here today They clearly have safety concerns, but they also have benefits. It's always a calculation.
Yeah, and I want to bring in a caller who is a practitioner. Jeff from Radnor is on the line, and we'll bring Dr. Horowitz back in just in a moment. But Jeff, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I'm a primary care provider in Radnor, part of a large health system. And, you know, to reiterate that last point, the majority of patients with mental health disorders are getting most of their care from their primary care doctor. And I really want to emphasize mental health is related to physical health. And anxiety can increase.
Yeah, and I'm having a tough time hearing you, Jeff. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, something with your connection. Why don't we jump to Bill on line two? Bill, what's your point of view for Studio 2 today?
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Dr. McIntyre, Dr. Horowitz, Cherry, and Kevin. I'm a big listener of Studio 2. Let me just cut to the chase. So I am all for informed consent and a level of skepticism about this, but I'm a patient who has benefited tremendously from SSRIs, has been concerned about the long-term ramifications of them, but has also not been able to effectively wean myself off them. I've been on them since I was 19. Mm-hmm. I went on them. I'm 40 now.
Yeah.
I went off of them in 2025 with consultation of a neurology team because I've been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which I was concerned was potentially caused by Celexa, mm-hmm. which I was on at 20 milligrams for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
At first, the taper went fine, and I was under supervision of a complex team of medical professionals. But eventually, I with some additional stressors in my life, which, you know, you can't avoid, you can't just put yourself in a box, I ended up in a very, very bad position. I was just a trigger warning for any folks out there. I mean, I just want to be candid about this. I attempted suicide twice. I was hospitalized three times. And I thought that I would never recover.
Yeah.
I truly did. I'm a professional. You know, I don't want to say too much more about that, just because I you know, I don't want to identify myself.
Well, thanks for sharing your perspective today with us, Bill.
But I just one quick point on this. I eventually recovered.
Mm-hmm.
I recovered because I was under the care of an excellent psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Who, I mean, helped me get back on a proper medication regimen. And I didn't think I was ever going to recover. And now I'm back to full steam, doing really, really well. I think informed consent is critical, but I really, really, really worry that folks are going to be deterred from doing what's absolutely essential for them.
Yeah.
If they're in my shoes, I was deeply skeptical of this treatment initially when I was 19 because my dad was diagnosed with drug-induced Parkinsonism right before I went on drugs myself. I applaud informed consent. I think everybody should get it. I think we should be careful about doing anything that could deter people from getting life-saving treatment. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you for that that story, and thank you for sharing with us. Again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And so, Dr. Horowitz, I mean, you heard what Bill had to say about how, you know, proper treatment changed his life. He's had some down points, but is back on track with his life. And so I want to sort of peel back the arguments. I want to talk about, just level set a little bit more for people. Just explain what an antidepressant is, who it's for, who it could really help.
Sure. So I guess the main thing to say about a story like Bill's, because it comes up all the time, is what is someone without the drug and what is withdrawal effects from the drug? So we know that after long-term use, people who come off antidepressants can get a series of withdrawal effects, some of which can be quite severe. They can get panic attacks, they can become very anxious, and they can become suicidal. Even people who haven't been like that before, they can get brain zaps and headaches and dizziness. And so when someone says, I know the drug is working for me, when I stop it, I feel a lot worse, it's actually not a strong argument that the drug is doing something. It may just be withdrawal effects. For example, to use a sort of analogy, if people stop smoking and feel very irritable and anxious, it's not a sign that the cigarette is very useful for them to use to prevent anxiety. It's a sign that withdrawal effects from cigarettes are very unpleasant and a sign to come off the drugs more slowly. And we know that today in America and around the world, Most doctors are getting people to come off their drugs very quickly in a few weeks. It's a bit tricky with existing tablets, and that can lead to some catastrophic outcomes. So I think the main message from Bill's story is coming off these drugs too quickly can be catastrophic, and I have seen people become very suicidal. I didn't hear him say he was like that before he started the drugs. And so we know that after years and years on these drugs, they change the brain, and coming off them leads to withdrawal effects, you know, very similar to nicotine or opioids. And that's an important issue for people to be aware of.
But I want to be clear, and maybe Dr. McIntyre, you can help with this, because one of part of Bill's message was, you know, he's afraid that people who need treatment, people who would actually benefit from antidepressants, won't seek the type of treatment that they need because they are reluctant, because they're hearing these conversations. Can you talk about what antidepressants do for the brain and who they are actually designed to help?
Sure.
Well, look, I'm horrified that people might be hearing that they should not be taking antidepressants if, in fact, they're a candidate to do so. What do they do? The answer is science is still trying to figure that out. Now, we have a hypothesis that they are affecting the way the brain operates. Specifically, the paradigm has shifted away from a chemical imbalance in the brain. Now we have a new heuristic, a new sort of framework implicating disturbances in the way the brain circuits, the networks are in interplay with each other. These are brain circuit problems that the antidepressants have a corrective effect on. So I'm horrified that people would take away that antidepressants, they should not be taking them. Second is, you know, Mark uses the language withdrawal. Recently, a good friend of mine, Joel Goldberg, and a whole group of folks, we published a document on this particular topic of antidepressant discontinuation. And a good friend and colleague, Ron Pies, and I did the same thing in another document. And what we called out is, well, I think words matter. And we're using the word withdrawal. I would use the word discontinuation syndrome, which is more agnostic. The reason is because when people take antidepressants, they don't like them. They don't take them because they like them. Secondly, is that there's no evidence that people crave antidepressants. And when we talk about withdrawal, the vernacular is more the valence of substance and alcohol, tobacco misuse. So discontinuation is the body's physiologic reaction to no longer having that substance in your body. The other part is, too, is I don't want people
Can I just jump in? I apologize. There's a difference between addiction and physical dependence. This is kind of a kind of company talking point. You know, I'm not saying that antidepressants are addictive. That's not true. But antidepressants cause physical dependence. When you take them, your body and brain adapts to them. And when you stop them, your body and brain calls out for them. And that's, in scientific terms, called withdrawal effects. It's not the same as being addicted. So, for example, I imagine that everybody in your audience is using caffeine. If they were to stop using caffeine, they'd get a withdrawal syndrome. Mm-hmm. No one is addicted and, you know, injecting caffeine or stealing from their neighbors. It's important to make the distinction that antidepressants cause physical dependence, whilst I agree with Roger not being addictive. But discontinuation symptoms is an industry term meant to minimize concerns about stopping the drugs. I don't think we should be using...
Dr. Horowitz, earlier, Dr. McIntyre said, you know, what do you mean by overprescribing? And I guess put that question directly to you. Like, if it's 1 in 6 are taking them now, do you want to see that as 1 in 3 or 1 in 12? I'm sorry. Like, what target are you after?
Look, it's not easy to give it an exact target, but I think if we step back and think, what is causing... I agree with Roger. There's a lot of people that are depressed and anxious. Absolutely in agreement with him on that. We have to think about what is causing that. You know, in America, it's about inequality, racism, you know, issues with jobs, relationship problems. There are all sorts of social determinants of people's mental health problems. And giving more and more medications doesn't get to the core of that. And we need to build safer societies, help people... therapy, support, all sorts of different things. You know, he has made an analogy between antidepressants and insulin. Now, when insulin was introduced into the market, amputations of diabetic limbs went down. That has not happened with antidepressants. There hasn't been a big tail off of anxiety and depression. It clearly has been, you know, a not very successful paradigm of help for people. So I think we need to step back and think, do we really need more and quicker acting and stronger antidepressants?
Yeah.
Or do we need to address the underlying causes of these issues?
And I think
it's pretty clear.
Can I react to that?
Yeah.
Can I react to that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
It is the position of the Food and Drug Administration, which actually is articulated in the package insert for all the antidepressants in the United States, that they actually reduce suicidality in people over the age of 25. In addition, study after study after study has shown that when people take antidepressants according to evidence-based guidelines and so on, suicide comes down. The second point, I want to come back to what
sorry,
Mark...
Sorry. I have to respond to that because that's simply not true. The FDA leaflet says that under the age of 25, suicidality is clearly increased. It does not say that it's reduced in adults, and studies from the FDA published in the British Medical Journal do not show an effect of antidepressants on suicidality. So it's just technically not true to say that these drugs are life-saving. You know, that's a very nice talking point, but it is not based on evidence, and I don't think your listeners should be misled in that way.
And let's bring in, if you could quickly respond. Dr. McIntyre.
Yeah, I just want to also pick up on something else as a conflation. How you end up somewhere and how you treat it may not be the same thing. So Mark had talked about, you know, social determinants. Well, people who end up with obesity end up there because of economic insecurity, housing insecurity, histories of trauma, adversity, and so on. Would you deny them a GLP-1 if they had severe obesity? I wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I think we're confusing the issue. I think we all agree that a GLP-1 is not the solution for obesity. What we agree is it's part of a larger comprehensive integrated plan. So we need to just sort of disambiguate.
Yeah. And let me just inject a couple comments here because we have Erica who direct messaged on Facebook. I was prescribed antidepressants after my son was born due to severe postpartum. I used them for three years and a year ago, I stopped. I came off of them lowering my dosage, then doing more CBT, which helped immensely. I decided to come off them because I didn't like the feeling of not feeling and didn't desire more medications. Many times I just had to sit and pray and stay away from antidepressants like alcohol. And she says she doesn't look to discourage people from taking medication, but she wants to encourage people to go deeper and seek out CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, over medication. And I was wondering, you know, and I'd like to get your take, Dr. Horowitz, because a lot of times, you know, you have primary care physicians writing prescriptions. What is the protocol for this? And I'm wondering, should there be some type of therapeutic treatment before a prescription is written? And if you have PCP sort of giving this, is that step sort of skipped in the process?
So I'll answer that. I just want to respond to one thing that Roger said about how effective these are, and if you compare them to GLP-1 drugs, I think there are very big differences. Number one, GLP-1 drugs seem to work very effectively. There are very big questions about the effectiveness of antidepressants. Roger said they work, but there are very big debates about the size of the effects of these drugs. They are very minimal on studies, very different from GLP-1 drugs, and also the way they work. You've heard from now a few different callers that they numb people's emotions, and that might make them feel better. That's very different from reversing underlying issues. If people can't cry, they can't enjoy aspects of life, is that really the fix that we're looking for?
And that's why I'm getting to this point, Dr. Horowitz. Should there be steps that doctors must take? Like the first step should be some type of therapeutic treatment before you go straight to a prescription.
I'm sure me and Roger both agree on that. You know, in the UK, that is standard procedure. If people have mild to moderate conditions, they're recommended not to use an antidepressant, to use things like CBT and other social interventions. And even for severe depression, the UK government says there are 11 equally effective treatments for depression, of which two involve antidepressants, and nine involve problem-solving therapy, various forms of therapy. And of course, all of those things have less side effects. They don't cause emotional numbing. So I do think there has been a very big shift towards pharmacological treatments as the mainstay in your country, and that needs to be rebalanced to match what's happening in other countries.
Because we're getting towards the end of the hour, Dr. Horowitz, could you just outline what you hope the future of mental health treatment is, specifically around the antidepressants we've been talking about? What's your vision for how it should go? And then Roger McIntyre, we'll give you that opportunity as well.
Look, I'd like to focus in on one very specific issue that we haven't really focused on, which is how to stop these drugs safely. Me and Roger can debate on how many people should be on the drugs. I think we can all agree people need to stop these drugs safely. After many years, it's very hard to come off these drugs in a few weeks. People often need longer times to come off. The last few milligrams can be much harder to come off. Coming off over months or longer, sometimes using liquids, can prevent some severe withdrawal effects that people experience. And stepping back from that, I think some of the issues we talked about are we need to think about other ways of treating mental health problems that don't cause so many health problems for people in the long term, that don't cause numbing, that don't cause a lot of the physical health problems that these drugs can cause. They can cause, you know, weight gain, diabetes, osteoporosis, falls and fractures in older people. They can cause memory impairments in younger people. They can cause emotional blunting and sexual problems. So we really need to think about broader ways of thinking about how to treat people.
Gotcha. And Dr. McIntyre, we got to give Dr. McIntyre time to close us out here.
Sure. There's three interrelated excitements I have for the future. First of all, the future antidepressants, which, by the way, have now arrived, are antidepressants that can work in 1 to 2 days. In other words, they work rapidly. Secondly, antidepressants that you don't need to take every day. Antidepressants you take intermittently. And thirdly, antidepressants that are not what we call nonspecific. Much of the side effects that Mark is correctly highlighting reflect the nonspecificity of the drugs that we've had. Newer drugs that are being developed are more specifically targeted to parts of the brain implicated in depression. And this is exciting because it suggests they might be better. That's a suggestion, mm-hmm. but also might reduce the safety and some of the problems we've had with tolerability. And these are exciting. This involves drugs that target the inflammatory system, the metabolic. We talked about the GLP-1s a moment ago. They're being repurposed as antidepressants. So it's a very exciting time. So rapidly working. You don't need to take them every day. And very innovative mechanisms.
Thank you. We got to stop it there. That was Roger McIntyre, professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at the University of Toronto. We also have been talking with Dr. Mark Horowitz, associate professor of psychiatry at Adelaide University. Thank you both so much for being on Studio 2 today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, and before we leave off, if you haven't heard it already, check out the latest episode of The Pulse, WHYY's Health and Science podcast. Their most recent episode is called Quitting Antidepressants, From Withdrawal to Tapering One Step at a Time, and it's absolutely worth a listen. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Al Banks and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. I'm executive producer Kevin McCory, sitting alongside Cherry Gregg.
Yes, thanks for listening.